on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
I got 65,000 downloads, which was incredible because, I mean, obviously I didn't know how much that would convert because it was free, but I did kind of go, well, something's going right here. There were then 65,000 copies of book one out there. And at the end of that, I put it up to 99 pence and it carried on selling.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. It's The Self-Publishing Show on a Friday, your weekly dose of indie inspiration and knowledge. My name is James Blatch.
My name's Mark Dawson. Hello.
Hello. Before we do anything else, I want to welcome our Patreon supporters, people who support the show, help it go on, because the show must go on. And this week we want to say a big shout out to Michael Allen Peck, Timothy Sparks, Barry Carter from Derby here in the UK, and Mo Akoff from FL USA. Welcome. Thank you very much indeed. They all went to Patreon or patreon.com/self-publishing show. Got themselves some goodies in the process of supporting the show. Thank you very much. It means a lot to us. Before we go on, we want to mention one of our early guests here on the Self-Publishing Show. It was back then. It was Self-Publishing Formula Podcast. Episode number 62, April 2017, was T.S. Paul. Came to our attention because he suddenly came from nowhere writing quite short stories that weren't always best formatted. Some had typos in them and was absolutely killing it with an adoring fan base right from the get-go. A lovely man to chat to. We got to know T.S. Paul, Scott Paul, as we got to know him at various conferences, particularly this time of year, actually, at NINC in Florida. And I'm very sorry to tell you that that Scott passed away last week. Our sympathies go to Heather, his wife. He was a character in our industry, no question about that. It all took him a bit by surprise when he first got going. And this is a little bit of the chat we had at the time.
I wrote the first 8 books sitting in the living room chair on a tray table.
Okay.
With my computer in front of me. Now I have a real actual physical desk. But before I just didn't have anything.
Okay.
And so I've got my own little office now. It's nice and quiet. Nobody's in here except for the cat. And but yeah, so, you know, it's been a real challenge. I mean, I had never written before. I was suddenly thrust into this, and then all of a sudden people are like, hey, when's the next book? And I'm like,
I better write that. There you go. As you can tell, infectious laugh, lovely man. Very sorry to hear that news. And I remember Mark at the time thinking that this was a great example of why that gatekeeping system that we had in the past wasn't as good as people thought it was in the industry, because T.S. Paul wouldn't have got through it. I can't see any way he would have got through it. He would have been shut down, knocked down several times. And his first books, yes, I mean, I read The Forgotten Engineer, one of his first books. It's an absolute page turner. The man has a gift for writing, and it was a tough write, actually. This woman was on her own in a space station. There's no other characters to bounce off. It was all in her mind. Really tough ride, but really absorbing. You wanted to know what happened next, which is the classic thing about stories. And yes, he's gone back and he's corrected the typos and the formatting and made everything better. But the idea that everything that followed that, that those books, which readers loved, the paranormal stuff that followed, the huge canon that he came up with, all of that would not have been there under the old system of you're not quite up to scratch, go back to your day job, is this great example of how this indie revolution is brilliant.
Yeah, he was. And I remember when, because Michael Anderley and Scott knew each other quite well. And I think Scott may have been one of the first admins on 20 Books as well. And I remember at the time, some people were basically railing against the fact that they were putting books out that didn't have the same kind of editing polish as others do. And it's never been something that I do. I mean, I'm always very keen and make a special effort to make sure my books are as polished as a traditionally published book would be. But that doesn't mean that my way is the only way or the right way. There are lots of different ways to do it. And my view has always been that it is all about giving readers what they want. And it's very clear that that Scott's audience loved what he wrote and the stories that he told. And at the end of the day, who cares? You know, that's the most important thing. They're actually buying those books, enjoying them, buying more. So it's not for me or for anyone really to tell an author what they should or shouldn't do. You know, my view, I think I probably told Scott this when we chatted, was that I personally would always want to invest in the product to make it as slick and professional as possible. But you know, he's proof that that's not the only way to do it. So yeah, lovely guy. Also, I remember he had a custom decorated van that he drove to Florida in, and he showed me. It was parked outside the Tradewinds Hotel with his characters on the sides and on the back. It was very striking. He was very proud of that, and I think he was you know, telling me that he'd actually sold books because people had seen his artwork on the side of this van and had then gone to Amazon and bought it. So interesting guerrilla marketing, but lovely guy and sadly missed.
Yes, he will be missed when we do finally get back to those conferences, and his readers are certainly going to miss him. I noticed that his wife Heather said that she's found a few short stories, stuff he was working on. She's going to make sure they're finished, completed, and she will certainly keep his publishing empire going. And it is an empire. So Scott Paul. Okay, we should say that the Self-Publishing Formula 101 course, Mark Dawson Self-Publishing 101, I should get the title right, is open. This is a foundation course for readers. The idea right at the beginning, Mark, was you said when you've written the end on the manuscript, we don't do craft, don't tell you how to write the book. We do have other courses. This course is not that. This takes that manuscript and you follow the course to build the foundation, the platform you need to sell it. That's the idea of the course, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the what we originally did was we did the ads course, Ads for Authors, or Facebook Ads for Authors, as it was in the early days. And that wasn't the original plan. My original plan was to put together a comprehensive course that covered everything. And as I've mentioned on the podcast before, as I realized how big that was and that I had no experience in this kind of thing, I just didn't have the confidence to put that together. So we kind of peeled off the Facebook advertising, which was the easiest. It was the thing I was best known for back then, and it was the easiest thing for us to do it in its own course. Of course, that turned out to be quite a large course by itself. And it was only when we kind of circled back, the Facebook Ads for Authors course had done very well, and we thought, okay, well, let's see if we can tackle the bigger subject. And I went back to it, and the intention has always been that 101 is the launch pad. So I don't know much about Cape Canaveral, but I'm sure that, you know, there's lots of things that you need to have in place in order to launch the rockets so they don't crash and blow up and all of that kind of stuff.
You are technically adept.
Yes. So yeah, that was the plan that we had, that 101 will teach you how to build your foundations, because you're not going to be able to build a career if your foundations are not strong enough. So and then the next course, the Ads for Authors course, works in tandem with that. So that's the rocket fuel. 101 is the launch pad, and when they're put together, that should be enough to take you from just getting started and hopefully selling more books. So yeah, 101 is a really good course. I'm very proud of it now. It's really comprehensive. It's everything that you need from, as you say, writing the end to getting your book on all the platforms and starting to sell some books. So building your mailing list, landing pages, websites, covers, a little bit of advertising in there as well. I think it's over 30 hours worth of content. So it is something that we're pretty proud of, and it's done really well. The students who've taken it have not everyone, of course, but most people are, I think, are glad that they've taken it, and our refund rate is pretty low, which is always a good indication that we're doing something right.
Yes, indeed. And you can find out everything you need to know about the course at selfpublishingformula.com/101. I was really hoping you were going to keep the rocket analogy going a bit longer. So thinking, so 101 is Kennedy. As you called it, Cape Canaveral. It's actually the Air Force Base, Cape Canaveral now, as everyone knows, but the Kennedy Space Center, where the vehicle's launched. And once it clears the tower, that's the end of 101. And then Mission Control in Houston at the Johnson Manned Space Center, that takes over. That's Ads for Authors after that.
God, you're boring.
And we'll talk about, I'll find something for the translunar injection TLI at some point. Okay, right. One final thing just to mention, which came up in our group last night, and you sort of alluded to it there, that you know, not everyone who takes the 101 course is going to go on to become a millionaire. Some might just break even. Some might just make pin money. Some might find it's not working for them. We do know that it's a very helpful course for people who have the right product. But there was a bit of someone posted into the group saying that they don't really want to continually hear how successful other authors have been because they found it annoying.
Yeah, that was the bit just for I did say last night that I was going to post something in that thread today because it's an interesting thread. I mean, I'm afraid I don't remember. I don't have my browser open at the moment, so I don't know who it was who posted that. But it was, I don't like looking at the groups where authors will tell people about their great months and how much money they've made. And then lots of other authors, you know, chimed in. And it was quite a supportive thread, actually, with people kind of echoing that sentiment. And also some, you know, kind of, I mean, Marie Force popped up and made a comment about just, you know, keep writing. That's the most important thing. You can't, you know, you're in the game. You wouldn't be in the game if it wasn't for, you know, being able to publish yourself. I was going to post something about my thoughts because it got me thinking as well. Then I thought, well, actually, it might be better. This could be quite a good subject for a podcast chat between me and you. So maybe we'll do that next week. Because I do have some thoughts about that, about, you know, success and comparisonitis. I do kind of understand why people feel that way. And you know, I'm not doing income reports this year, and I haven't done since about December. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't. It's quite a tricky one. Perhaps we'll talk about it a bit more when we do the podcast. But it's a tricky balance between wanting to celebrate it, I suppose, and to show what's possible. And also, as someone who's selling courses, like the 101 course, it's important that potential students know that I know what I'm talking about. Because there are lots of other courses now, more all the time. And some of those tutors, if you look at their sales, they aren't selling anything. So, you know, you have to question, why would you want to learn from someone who isn't doing that? So that was one of the ways that I tried to give people confidence that I can teach them and I know what I'm talking about. But on the other hand, I am aware that is not always, some people will look at that and they won't feel good about it. So I stopped. I think it could be quite a good chat to kind of think about as authors are starting out.
Mindset and motivation and expectations and so on. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's schedule that in. Maybe for next week or the week after. That would be a good chat. And of course, if you're not in our community Facebook group, it is a good place for these kind of stimulating discussions. You'll find it on Facebook. So it's Self-Publishing Formula. I'm being bombarded because I clicked on one guy who's selling an Amazon ads course at the moment, and he looks like a snake oil salesman. I won't mention his name because I can't be bothered if he gets back to me legally. But he looks like a snake oil salesman. He's pushing this Amazon ads course, and I had a look on Amazon. He's got three books on Amazon, and they are all ranked at 1.7 million. Mark, sort of 1.5.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah, that's everything you need to know about this guy. And he does use the words guaranteed. And he talks about $100,000 a month income, and he talks about it being guaranteed.
Yeah, one of these days someone is going to be sued by someone, because that's all kinds of wrong. And people are, you know, courses aren't cheap sometimes, and it's, you know, it's people are being ripped off. We see it all the time.
I think this guy sells his course at $97, and I think that's probably how he thinks he gets away with it. The people just think,
it's still $100.
It's still $100, but it's only $97, so I'm not going to make that big a fuss. But I get the feeling he's somebody who may have worked out how to reinvent himself and move away from the court cases each time. Anyway, let's park him there.
Tell me off air, I'll check him out.
Yeah. Okay, look, we have somebody who's been very successful, on the podcast today. Of course, we are generally drawn to people who've been successful in this area. That's what we're doing here, exploring how and why. This guy is from England. He's from South London, now lives in Snowdonia, which is a beautiful part of Wales. And he has created a character really based on his own move from South London to Snowdonia, a policeman who thought maybe he's going to get a nice quiet life. Turns out, of course, there's been a murder in the village. There's sort of, I guess, police procedural stroke cozy murder type area. Anyway, he's been enormously successful. He's a great writer, and his name is Simon McLeave.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Simon McLeave, thank you so much indeed for being on The Self-Publishing Show, a fellow BBC survivor.
Yes, from back from the 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
In the good old days.
My name is James, and I've been free of the BBC since 2006. Okay, well, look, it's a large organisation. I was in the grotty news end of things, and I was always jealous about the people who made proper programmes that I went home and watched in the evening. And that's the sort of thing that you were doing. So you better give us a little bit of your background, Simon.
Yeah, I started working in script development way back in the sort of early 90s. So I worked as a script editor on various BBC shows, developed a lot of stuff, worked with a lot of writers. Basically, my job was to go and find writers that I liked and find projects I liked and try and put the two together or work on a series. So I worked on various series within the BBC. So it was great. It was a good time. And I was young, so it was kind of, is all part of the fun was being in that place and working in the media.
And how do you get into being a script editor and being in that position as somebody so young? Had you done much writing to that point?
No, it's not. Basically, what happens is you first of all become a script reader.
Okay.
So I sort of touted myself around and banged on doors and sort of begged people to give me some feature film scripts to read. So I started by working for Miramax, actually, way right back. And some Island Films and people like that. So they would pay me a pittance to go away and read a feature film script, write a synopsis and come back and say whether I thought it was half decent. And for some reason, they trusted me to do that. And that led to kind of, more opportunities so that eventually I got into the BBC for a while.
Yeah. And so you're doing that. Did you get to the point of writing scripts in the BBC or?
Yeah. Well, then I went freelance. So then I decided, right, well, I think I can do this. I can probably do this better than some of the people I'm working with, which is highly arrogant, but I thought I'd give it a go. For a while I did a lot of work for the Bill, the good old Bill. And I wrote for Sight and Witness and EastEnders and Holby and loads of other kind of stuff. So, it was good. It was good while it lasted. It's a difficult thing because it's such a factory and you are given, you're given what's going to happen in your episode. You're told the beats that you have to hit.
Right.
You had a very prescriptive script editor and producer, so it's very tightly reined. So there's not a huge scope for creativity there. So it's okay,
So you're almost filling in the blanks from somebody else who's already worked out how the episode's going to flow.
Exactly. You are. You're kind of filling in the blanks with a bit of dialogue. And it's very brutal as well. So they're quite happy to ring up and say that's rubbish what you've done and we'll move on and get someone else to do it. It's not, as a writer in the TV, and certainly in the TV world on those series, you are bottom of the pile. And at the same time, I was trying to kind of get away, feature films or original TV series ideas. But they're so difficult. There's so much money you need just to get the ball rolling. So you get a few rolling and then it nearly comes off. But that's the only way to really be truly creative. I sort of had enough. It got to the point actually when a bill was going out and I wasn't watching it because I'd had such a terrible time on it.
Right.
And my wife went, well, if you're not even watching the stuff you're writing going out, do you not think maybe you should go and do something else that you want to do? So I did a decade as a teacher.
So it's what we'd call today a toxic environment that you're working in.
Yeah, it's unforgiving, it's brutal, and it's very, very different actually to how I found the book world. It completely comes apart. So
you go off and you teach. What ages were you teaching?
Secondary school, okay. Teaching English and media, which is fantastic. It's an amazing job. It is a fantastically rewarding job, but it's exhausting. So while I was there, I think I dusted myself down and had a few years of not thinking about writing at all. And then in the last few years, people started to say, well, why are you not writing? Why have you never, written a book? Or why you should just start to write again. And I just started to kind of think of ideas and suddenly got the bug again and kind of got that mojo back where I actually thought, well, maybe I'll give this a go. So
And that, was that novels you were thinking about at that stage?
Yeah, I had an idea for a crime story. And I think because of the experience of writing, of trying to get a TV series away, or trying to get a feature film away, I thought, I'm going to write the book that I want to write. I'm going to write the story that I want to write without anyone being prescriptive about it. And I'll see what happens. And I suppose I spent a good 2 years messing around with that. But I kind of, I just enjoyed the process because I was in charge. And I also thought that possibly it was easier to get a novel away, or at least get it into the hands of other people to read, than it would be to get a TV series or a feature film developed. So it was kind of that sort of choice. And, you know, I love reading, so it kind of fitted in with that.
Well, you're the perfect example of what we celebrate now as the loss of gatekeepers and agents and people in your way, the complete control, which must, I mean, in contrast to the prescriptive days of working on those serial dramas, must have been a refreshing experience.
Oh, it's incredible the amount of freedom I have. And the other thing I've enjoyed actually about writing novels, which differs from the scripts, is you can write the internal dialogue. So with scripts, it's all about what you don't write. It's all about nuance. And what I've really enjoyed writing the book so far is to be able to explore what someone thinks when they say one thing, they mean something else, or, you know, driving along, what are they thinking about, something completely different. And I, you know, in terms of character development, I found that really rewarding. So it's been really, really good. Yeah.
You mean we didn't need all that internal dialogue in Blade Runner, did we?
No.
As it turned out. Okay, so let's talk about the books then. So you said you spent 2 years tinkering about with this one idea at the beginning.
Yeah. I kind of tinkered around with it for about 2 years, just thought, got a couple of people to read it, and some people, you know, my mum is my target audience, basically, because of her demographics. So good old mum read it and went, well, that's similar to all the stuff that I read. I gave it to someone else who likes crime novels. They went, yeah, I can't really see the difference between that and the stuff that I'm reading at the moment. And I kind of thought, well, they're biased and they're bound to say that, whatever. But I kind of thought that was a good sign. At least they didn't say, don't bother and go back and carry on teaching. So I did approach, because I still had some contacts, I did approach a couple of agents. I did not in any sort of meaningful way, but just a couple. And it was sort of stay in touch, but not at the moment. And then I happened to come across an article about Mark Dawson, and suddenly started listening to your podcast and went, oh my God, there's a way of actually producing this without having to go through, get an agent, wait for 6 months. And I know, you know, from working on the other side that the publishing business is so slow. So, you know, by the time you've handed your first draft in, you know, you're lucky if it's out the same year.
Yeah, it's a couple of years, can't it?
Yeah. So this idea of writing what you want, having, you know, complete and utter artistic control over the content, was just like, I mean, it's like my dream. And obviously I had no idea whether anyone would buy it, but it was very exciting just to start the ball rolling, really.
Yeah. So tell us about the book, that first one.
I'm a South Londoner, and because my wife's from North Wales, near Snowdonia, and we moved up here about 14 years ago. And I quite enjoyed that experience of being from, like, you know, big city, 38 years in South London, and then coming to a place which is very tiny. Everyone knows everyone's business. And I always thought there was a mine in there for stories generally, because the quirks of the sort of Welsh culture as opposed to being from London and all that kind of, the sort of small town, small village kind of mentality. So I thought, well, there's something there. And I just thought about a police officer deciding that South London is way too dangerous at the moment and thinking, right, well, I'll go and I'll see out my pension in North Wales and the North Wales Police Force. So that's my character, Ruth Hunter. She's a DI in Peckham, which is, you know, a really frightening place to be at any kind of police officer. And she decides to up sticks. She's had various kind of personal traumas. So she decides to go to Snowdonia. And obviously it doesn't quite work out quite as quietly. Otherwise I wouldn't have a series to write.
Yeah.
So she's literally unpacking her bags when the call comes through. There's been a murder. at a school, teacher's been killed in a car park, and she races off to basically be in charge because she's so experienced. You know, she's from the Met. She's instantly in charge of the investigation, which is so not what she wanted to do. And she gets, her partner is Nick Evans, DS Nick Evans, who's a fiercely proud Welshman, doesn't like Englishmen, doesn't talk about his feelings, loves rugby. And they are chalk and cheese. And in the first book, first couple of books, they start to warm to each other. By the book, I mean, I'm writing book 7 at the moment now, they are best of buddies. It's, somehow their relationship and their partnership works.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the first book.
Sounds like a great landscape for a, I guess, a regional detective series, to quote Alan Partridge.
It
was one of his pitches, well, wasn't it? Swallow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing was, I also, you know, with my sort of TV head on, I looked around and thought of all the TV series and crime novel series that we've had, and sort of thought, I don't think anyone's done anything based in Snowdonia, which seems crazy because it's so perfect.
Yeah.
And it's staggeringly beautiful. And you know, it's close to places like Liverpool and Manchester on one side, you've got the coast on the other side, and you've got the mountains. I just thought, well, thinking of kind of, you know, Nordic noir and all that, or Celtic noir, I thought this has to be a great place to set a TV series or a detective series. So that was another sort of thought in my head as I started to write.
And how did you go about marketing and launching book one?
Pretty much did everything that I listened to the podcast. I gave myself 12 months to gen up on it. So I had the book ready, and then I had a second book ready. So I actually waited for the two books to be completed and started working on the third. I then pretty much immersed myself in SPF podcasts. I did the two courses, the 101 and the ads. I read every book by Joe Penn and David Cochrane and, you know, all those guys. I mean, literally sort of as though I was kind of doing a degree in self-publishing. And so when I started, I was I had quite a lot of, you know, to do. I had a fair amount of knowledge. I wasn't finding my way through it. And the first thing I did was offer 4 chapters free to join their mailing list. So I built a mailing list that way. I didn't want to do novella, but realized that was the best way. So I built a mailing list, got about 2,000-3,000 on that, built some ads, got a really good cup. You know, the other thing is that I sort of looked at what everyone else was doing. So, you know, Stuart did my covers, Stuart Patch, Brian came into my, I kind of did what I was basically, I followed everything that I was told would be the best, best thing to do.
Just to jump back a second, you said you got 2,000 to 3,000 on your mailing list using chapters as a giveaway.
Yeah. I basically said, yeah, have the first 4 chapters for free and get a free, and basically I was going to do a freebie. So, and get a free copy of this in January.
Right.
So the idea was that basically you can have four chapters now, but also you're going to get this, book in free. And it kind of, you know, worked. And I did some lead gen ads on Facebook. Didn't spend a huge amount.
Okay.
But it seemed to work. And I think the cover, I mean, the other thing is that the cover is superb, and, you know, Stuart Batch did an amazing job on that. And I think that really, really helped.
Yeah, it's incredibly important. Did you have a tagline for the book?
God, probably, I can't remember off the top of my head. But
anyway, comes to launch. As you said, January is when you launched it.
Yeah.
And how did that go?
I got 65,000 downloads.
Wow.
which was incredible because, I mean, obviously I didn't know how much that would convert because it was free, but I did kind of go, well, something's going right here.
Yeah.
I remember getting 6,500 on one day and thinking, what on earth is happening? Because I sort of, you know, there was part of me that just fully expected this to be a hobby and for me to be still teaching and for me to be selling, you know, 100 books a month and it could have gone like that. I had absolutely no idea. But yeah, that kind of, obviously there were then 65,000 copies of book one out there. And at the end of that, I put it up to 99 pence and it carried on selling.
How long was it free for?
The first month, so January.
Okay. So for January, then it goes to 99p. And what was your schedule for releasing book two?
That came in 2 weeks later. So mid-February. So I did six, so 4 weeks free, 2 weeks, and then book two came out at 99 pence mid-February. And that, again, that sold, started to sell really well on the back of book one. They both started selling really well.
And so both books were at 99p in February then?
Yeah.
Okay. And it did sell, because obviously that's the test really, how book two sells.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it went through the roof. And I was sort of looking at it thinking, this must be wrong. I don't understand what's going on. And then, I mean, I then decided, I spoke to a couple of authors in my genre actually, and wondered whether about putting up to 199. So end of February, I put them both up to 199 and didn't really see a massive drop, not a huge drop, a little drop, but then, you know, the kind of the profit made up for it. And book three by that point was ready to go. So mid-March. So I'd released three books in the space of 10 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
And then again, that built on that, and that went through the roof as well. So,
and that was what year was this?
This year.
He's done this all in 2020. And now you're at book seven.
Yeah. Book six comes out in 10 days, and then book seven sort of October, November time.
And can you give us an idea of how you're doing in sales now?
To date, I've sold 125,000 copies of ebooks and paperbacks across the board, and probably the same in KU.
Fantastic.
I think that's sort of knocking on the door a quarter of a million, which is ludicrous.
So I don't know how that happened. This is a fully fledged career for you now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, no more teaching for me for a while at least.
And what's, I think, is interesting about this strategy, you've taken on board all this knowledge, you've taken on faith that this is a good way of doing things. And then you've made decisions to give your book away, which is a mental hurdle that some people never get over and never get through. Secondly, to price your books at 99p, where you're basically making about 60p or whatever them, which is another mental hurdle people don't do. Both books, not just book one, book two. And the result of all of this has been a fantastic foundation of readership for you, which is obviously paying massive dividends now.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, you know, I think obviously I have confidence that someone reads book one, they're going to want to read book two, and so on. That, you know, that model doesn't work at all if those books don't lead you to the next book, and so far they have. And the other thing is, I you know, for me, it was a bit of a no-brainer. If you get 65,000 people reading your book, you only need 10% of them or even 5% of them to actually go on to buy book two. And suddenly you're ranking in the Amazon charts. So, you know, it seemed obvious to me that that's what other people have done. They've made a success of it. So why not follow that model?
Yeah, well done for doing that. So let's talk about your writing process. You're obviously quite fast. Quite prolific and fast.
Yeah. 2,000-3,000 words a day.
Do you plot?
I always know the ending. So for me, it's the twist. For me, I think my books work, I think, because there's always a moment where everyone goes, oh my God, no. What the hell? How can that possibly be? You know, that sort of moment where you sort of completely thrown by a twist.
So I start
with that.
That's what Peter James said to us when we interviewed him in New York. He said, every book has to have a fuck me moment.
Exactly, the fuck me moment. So basically, I start with that and go, right, what is the fuck me moment at the end of this book where everyone just goes, oh my God, I didn't see that coming. And then work backwards, covering the, you know, tracing it back and going, right, what? How do I cover that? How do I make sure that no one at the beginning or middle or end spots that coming?
And there's a real art to that, isn't there? Because you know what's coming.
Yes,
and there's the temptation to do a little bit of foreshadowing here and there, but there's a balance, I guess. Do you end up writing and then scrubbing sentences out thinking, no, that's giving too much away? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that balance between, you know, the slightest hint, but, you know, readers are so savvy these days. They're always, you know, they sit there looking for, you know, the least obvious option for the killer. And then they're looking for the, you know, the tiniest clue that gives that away. So, but then what you can't do is have it so out of the blue that everyone goes, well, that's ridiculous.
Makes no sense.
The postman who we haven't seen since, you know, 3 days ago. So, yeah, it's a balancing act, and I suppose you just kind of play around with it.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's instinctive, I think. For me, anyway, it's instinctive. So you sort of, as you're writing, your instinct tells you when to rein back and when you can kind of open up a bit.
And how much help was that, that toxic environment that you were in all those years ago? How much help is, in terms of a foundation as a writer, is that to you?
Definitely in terms of work ethic and just pumping out, you know, work and sort of believing that what I'm writing is okay, I suppose. Yeah, you know, the other thing is structure. You know, I'm sort of, I can, you know, I know the three-act structure, the turning points, midpoints, you know, climaxes, all that stuff is kind of second nature. So as I'm writing it, I kind of know when I need to shift a gear or completely throw everything around so that the middle act starts. So that's invaluable. And that's almost part of my DNA, I suppose, now, because I've been doing it for so long. And the way that scenes work as well. I mean, you know, yes, it's the idea that, you know, if this scene doesn't move the plot or character on, it's not in there. It's not, that scene's not in the book. So that stuff is really rigorous when you're writing on a series. And I guess that's been brilliant in terms of then applying that to a crime novel.
What's the word count of your novels?
It was going down, I think. First one was about 100. Currently about 80.
Okay. And you have, do you do any development editing, or do you go just straight to sort of proofing?
You know, yeah, I still do development editing. I've got an amazing editor who pretty much taught me to write novels in the first book. So wow. I'm internally grateful to her, because I had basically all the bad habits of being a screenwriter came out in that first book, and about POV and head hopping and all that kind of right. stuff. And so she basically kind of drilled that out of me gently. And held my hand through the first book. And I've used her ever since. She's very, very good at looking at the first or second draft and spotting when a character's not acting in the way that she would expect, or plot holes, or, you know, a fantastic idea of moving. Like, if you move that scene back, that will make that act much, much pacier, or... so yeah, I don't think I can do that. I think I'm too close to the book when I hand it to her to do that.
You can name check her if you want.
Rebecca Miller, M-I-L-L-A-R.
It just sounds to me like she deserves some public credit here.
Yeah, God, yeah, no, she's, I know she's very busy, but I'm sure, she's a fantastic editor, and she does the copy edit. Mm. And then I get it proofread. So it goes through a few changes.
And you know more or less what's going to happen in the novel when you write it, so you work backwards from the moment. What about over the series? I mean, have Nick and Ruth panned out in the way that you very first envisaged, or has that happened organically as you wrote their relationship, etc.?
Yeah, that's completely organic. Often I don't quite. There's an ongoing story about Ruth is the central character, and she had a partner in London who vanished, basically got on a train 7 years ago from Crystal Palace to Victoria and vanished off the face of the earth. And no one knows what happened to her. So there is an ongoing story through each book where Ruth is trying very slowly to kind of unpick that case and find out where she is or what happened to her. So I know that has to kind of keep going, but where they end up is the one thing that I sort of get an instinct by the end of the book where they might go to the next book, but I don't, I certainly don't have an arc for the next 7 books to see where they're going to go.
And is there a Moonlighting-esque romantic tension there, or is that not like that at all?
No, because she's gay, so
so that's not
kind of, that also simplifies it.
Yes,
and she's very open about it, and he, you know, and it's, I think that works really well because there's no sexual thing. They are like mates, so that works really well for that couple.
So will there be a book which will be geared around the resolution of her missing partner, do you think, at some point?
Somewhere.
Yeah.
Although there's part of me that, I mean, some people have already sort of emailed me to say, you do know that if once you resolve that, the series finishes. So I'm holding off while it's still selling well and everyone's clamoring for more. So, I roughly know how it ends, but it's still, it's a way off.
Okay, so just to finish up on the writing side of it, so 2,000 to 3,000 a day is what you're aiming at. And you write in, you write in the morning, do you write in Scrivener? Give us a little bit of idea of your process.
So I get up I write in 1,000 word sort of blasts, really, and I can kind of do that in normally an hour and a half. And sometimes I'll get one or two of those done in the morning and then think, right, well, I'll do another one later on. I think it's hard. I find it very hard to kind of get all that done in the morning because it's kind of the concentration. It just kind of takes it out of you. So I'm quite happy to do 1,000 words and then go off and do some emails or look at some ads and then come back to it or go for, you know, walk the dog or go for a run and then come back to it. So actually, I mean, I haven't heard this before, but I sort of tend to space it out. And sometimes even in the evening, I'll go back to it and write another 500 words. So it's not done in one block and got out of the way, which probably would make more sense. But
Whatever works.
It works.
Yeah,
it works. So
it clearly is working for you. Okay, let's talk about marketing then. So you ran some lead gen ads in those early days to build a sort of foundation mailing list. What's your marketing setup look like today?
Mainly through Amazon ads. Most of my spend goes on that. Running a few Facebook ads at the moment. Dabbled in BookBub. Sort of lost a lot of money very quickly. I think you have to be very, very patient with BookBub and do a lot of testing. And sometimes I get a bit impatient and sort of chuck a load of money and then it all disappears. So I need to kind of work on that. But yeah, Amazon ads, probably 3/4 of my spend is on that. Targeting, you know, genre, key, you know, certain keywords or you know, also boards and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, you'll be pleased to know there is another BookBub course coming along. At some point, being authored by BookBub themselves. So hopefully that'll. I've literally just started with the books that we're marketing on BookBub, and I must be the only person in the world who can't get it to spend. Everyone says they lose money quickly on BookBub, but my ads have sat there doing almost nothing. But anyway, I need to get into it so that I can understand what I'm looking at when I edit the course. Good. Okay. So I mean, congratulations, Simon. This sounds like a fantastic SAP. You know, you've got application, which is a key thing for a writer to have. And also, it just seems to me like you've worked really efficiently. You've really focused down on the areas that you need to, where are going to give you the best possible return, and worked on them rather than spent time experimenting and failing. I guess that's the beauty of having people like Mark around to listen to.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, I think I've been very lucky because I've heard Mark say this about, you know, the sort of regionally based crime books are doing very well. You know, J.D. Kirk or Jason Dalgleish.
L.J. Ross, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't know that, I promise. So it wasn't a kind of right-to-market thing. It was literally, I love crime. I love crime novels and I love crime TV and film. And I happen to live near Snowdonia and I put the two together and I guess I lucked out because that is definitely a market at the moment where I can tell from anecdotally and from my advertising that, you know, people hoover them up. They really do. And, you know, I get kind of people saying, I've read all 5 of your books in 3 days. Right in the next one.
Wow.
So I kind of feel quite lucky that I kind of hit that market. But it's been a quite a ride this year. Yeah, it's been amazing.
That's what you want. You want those whale readers, they call them, don't they? People who just consume.
Yeah. They're all women over 60. I don't know what that's about, but they're sort of crime. They're fascinated by by killing and crimes. So I don't know what's going on with that, but no, long may it last.
Yes, well, it sounds like you've got a great platform for it. Do you think so at the moment your plan is to stick with this series? Obviously, you've got this development in Ruth's life to happen at some point. Have you got any ideas for any other series?
I should do. I should do because I think, you know, it's another way into the first series, isn't it? I've got an idea about a kind of family of cops. So at different levels. So so it's not a family saga, but, you know, sort of running off each person within the family, 3 generations of a family, they all have their own stories within each book. So I've kind of toying around with that. And there is a gangster character that I've created called Curtis Blake, who's a Liverpudlian drug dealer. And I'm sort of toying with a Sopranos-esque kind of delve into his life somewhere in like Southport near Liverpool and what it's like. But I'm not sure I want to do the research. It sounds a bit dangerous. But those are my two ideas at the moment.
Go and score some smack up in Liverpool just to see how the process works.
Terrifying.
Yeah. Well, you lived in Peckham, so you know. I used to live over the hill in Camberwell. I can remember those days.
Oh, yeah. It was a little bit rough around the edges.
Yeah, but extraordinary London, because it'd be rough around the edges, but also you'd get these glorious townhouses right next to. I've always loved that about London. It's not, there's no no-go areas, because you literally get very middle class little boutique shops and then huge tenement blocks side by side, don't you?
Yeah, I got friends who kind of were in Brixton 5 years ago when Brixton was pretty rough around the edges, and it's gone through the roof, and it's now, you know, £2 million for a house.
Yeah.
And there are cheese shops in Brixton, so, you know, who knew?
So Ruth thought everything would be slower moving in Snowdonia, but obviously you've got other ideas.
It's all the dark, crazy Welsh stuff has all come out, and there are serial killers and all sorts of things going on.
Of course. Well, Simon, thank you so much indeed for sharing that with me. I'm full of admiration for you, and I think this is a very accessible story for people setting out to sort of apply yourself and listen to the experts and follow their advice, rather than, you know, strangely, some people do sort of rail against common wisdom, but clearly there's a reason for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, this morning I was looking on, just, you know, scooting through Amazon, and some of the covers, you know, that I'm not being arrogant in any way, but I look at book covers for crime books and go, that does not look like a crime book cover. Okay, do you think that someone's going to, you know, who reads Ian Rankin or Linda LaPlante book is going to go and buy that book because it looks the same? If not, there's no point, is there?
No.
They're basically not going to buy it straight away without even looking at what it's about. So,
and we can never underestimate how much people don't know, and why should they at the beginning? Because you're a writer rather than a marketer, and even recognizing a genre cover is not something necessarily sat down and thought about before. So there's a big world of people out there who don't know the basics. And I don't mean that rudely, it's just the way it is. But clearly you do. So you mentioned Linda LaPlante, of course, we interviewed in New York a couple of years ago, but she was presumably a writer you must have rubbed shoulders with at some point in your TV days.
I did come across her when I did a bit of work on Prime Suspect and came across her there. So she's a live wire.
She certainly is.
And she's got I remember being in the bar with her and her telling some fantastic stories for about 4 hours about life as an actress and life in Liverpool and all sorts of stuff. So, she's great.
Yeah.
And she paved the way, really, for us, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, she's a hell of a character. And you say she went through, she was, you know, blonde and attractive and an actress in her early days. And that meant that she was completely pigeonholed by almost everyone she met and had to really fight her way into being a writer. So if you want to listen to Linda LaPlante, go back to our New York episode a couple of years ago, I think it was. Really, we could have probably gone on for about 4 hours listening to her raconteur. But so there you go. Okay, look, Simon, thank you so much indeed for joining us from beautiful Snowdonia.
Well, thank you, James.
We've seen a bookcase at least, but we know out the window it looks lovely. And and best of luck with the rest of the books.
Lovely. Thanks very much, James. Take care.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Got quite a few accents for me going into that interview. Do you?
Yeah, we had
to you.
South London, I think, and South. Then I think we may have had Taggart from Glasgow.
Mother in Peterborough, Edinburgh.
They all sound just like you, though. That's
we had we had a Scottish reporter called Ross McWilliam at Look East when I was working there, and whenever he walked into the newsroom, people said, "There'll be the mother in Peterborough," which I think is the Taggart thing.
Was that funny
UK
for very
long? Crime guy. It was very, very funny. The long winter nights flew by, I can tell you. Anyway, Simon, what a fantastic guy to speak to.
I'm sure he did.
Yes. There's scope. I mean, you're writing. You've got Eurotacus, not Finch. Obviously, Eurotacus. What's he
Priest.
Called? Priest, that's it. Atticus Priest. Books. You know, we can think about L.J. Ross. And there's a big bank of writers now who write these really enjoyable detective series. Barry Hutchinson's another one. And I guess that's that thing that we explore every now and again, Mark, is that readers aren't necessarily looking for the next new thing, which the publishing industry often thinks they are. They're looking for the same thing again, because that's what they enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, people, you know, the Milton series now is 18 books strong, and a few reviewers have noted that it's the same formula. And it is, you know, Milton arrives in a new place, someone needs his help, Milton helps him, and he goes off somewhere else. And that is basically the formula. And but most readers, I mean, as I've said before, each new book in the series does better than the previous one. So readers are still enjoying that. They know what they're going to get. They are, I think most of them enjoy that, and they come back for more. So, you know, as long as that's their expectation, I'll keep trying to fulfill it for them. And, you know, and the same will go with Atticus. There'll be, you know, the same tropes and, well, the tropes are appropriate to his particular genre. I'll keep trying to hit those so that readers get what they're expecting, because you start subverting those expectations and you find that readers don't necessarily want to buy the second book quite so much.
Yeah. Well, I told you about my friend Nick, who I play cricket with, who picked up one of your books. We just coincidentally in a conversation standing in the slip said he was reading this book and it sounded a bit like yours. And I said, is it Mark Dawson? He goes, yeah. Anyway, I spoke to him last weekend and he's on book 16 or something of John Milton. So he's just gone through the series, which I think is...
Yeah, it happens quite a lot. It's nice to hear that. I don't get bored of people telling me that because it means I'm doing something right. So that's good.
You are. Okay. Right. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Thank you to our guest, Simon McCleave. Don't forget the self-publishing 101 course is open for a couple of weeks. You can go to selfpublishingformula.com/101. That's the digits 101. Good. That's it. All that leaves me to say is that it is a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.